But I felt so strongly, I said that if I have any credibility as secretary, I have to really do everything I can to protect and promote the health of Americans. And this is a blatant effort that really goes in the opposite direction.
That was Dr. Lewis Sullivan talking about a speech he gave in 1990 to medical students at the University of Pennsylvania, in which he criticized R.J. Reynolds for creating a cigarette that they marketed specifically toward Black people. In response to Sullivan's speech and further public outrage, R.J. Reynolds withdrew its plan to market the cigarette, called Uptown. Sullivan, an internist and hematologist, was secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services from 1989 to 1993. As HHS secretary, Sullivan established the NIH Office on Research and Minority Health and the Women's Health Research Program. In 1975, Sullivan was named founding dean and director of the Medical Education Program at Morehouse College. In 1981, the four-year Morehouse School of Medicine was established with Sullivan as dean and president. In this interview, Sullivan speaks with Dr. Alan Blum, director of the Center for the Study of Tobacco and Society at the University of Alabama. Blum is serving as guest editor this month as we examine the legacy of the 1964 Surgeon General's Report on Smoking and Health.
I'm honored to be interviewing Dr. Lewis Sullivan, who was the Secretary of Health and Human Services in George H.W. Bush administration from 1989 to 1993. But more than that, Dr. Sullivan is simply a wonderful person. I'm Dr. Alan Blum. I was asked by the Cancer Letter, and in particular, Alex Carolyn, who edits the Cancer History Project, wondered if I might interview Dr. Sullivan for a podcast that we're going to issue for the 60th anniversary of the release of the Surgeon General's Report on Smoking and Health by Dr. Luther Terry, who was from Alabama. And so that's the connection that I have for the University of Alabama Center for the Study of Tobacco and Society, along with Mickey LeMaitre, who was an alumnus of this university. And you could say that Alabama was the only state that had two individuals on that report. So I wanted to first explore your own thoughts about this anniversary, since you played perhaps one of the most significant roles in furthering this issue, along with, of course, Dr. Terry, Dr. Koop, and of course, Julius Richmond, who was the Secretary of Health, who was so great, and then Joe Califano. I think those are the names that one thinks of in the government that took those risks to say, this is so important, we've got to stand up for this issue.
Right. It was very important, and I certainly was quite impressed by that report when it came out. Because my own personal circumstances were as follows. I grew up in Southwest Georgia, having been born here in Atlanta. And my father actually was a funeral director, but he had a little confectionery. And I would frequently be minding the store. And I remember back in those years, back in the 40s and 50s, many advertisements were out, such as there are more doctors smoking Camels, or Lucky Strikes were the favorite cigarette of doctors. So those cigarettes at that time were being promoted as really desirable objects that were being used by doctors. So when the Surgeon General's report came out in 1964, pointing out that the individuals who smoked had a higher incidence of illness and death from lung cancer, that was very striking. So that is something that stayed with me the whole time, because I had graduated from medical school in 1958. And so I was very much into health issues. And so the Surgeon General's report, I thought, was very important. Got a lot of attention, really turned the whole picture around, showing that this was not a harmless hobby, but rather a very danger to one's health and longevity.
You know, it's very interesting that I just realized you were an eyewitness to the release of the report. I was a high school senior, and I wrote my first editorial on smoking in 1964. My father handed me a copy of the Journal of the American Medical Association with an editorial called Childish Habit, I believe. And I wrote the same title, but I adapted it for my own newspaper. But this was the report, and you were there. You had graduated from Boston University School of Medicine after having been a magna cum laude graduate at Morehouse. You epitomize the values and the greatness of Morehouse. And I want to come back to that in just a minute. But what an incredible bio to read about you. We all think of you as Secretary of Health, but I hadn't realized the depth of what you had done prior to that. And you founded a medical school. I was at Emory when Morehouse was just in its infancy. Mm-hmm. I graduated in 75. And I watched the growth. My uncle Marvin Goldstein and another uncle Irving Goldstein were contributors in Atlanta to various organizations. One was the Ben Macell Dental Clinic, and they were very, very interested in Morehouse. It's just fantastic to see how that college, which is separate from the university, but has become one of the most one of the foremost medical schools, not just for minority physicians, but for the healthcare of Atlanta.
Well, I knew Dr. Goldstein, and he was very generous as one of our financial supporters, as well as someone who gave us a lot of encouragement for the medical school. So that's very interesting. That really was very exciting time, very challenging, but we had a lot of supporters like Dr. Goldstein and others who worked with us.
Yeah, it was when I first gave a talk at Morehouse on smoking, it was absolutely a great moment to walk into that building and because I think at the time that hadn't been named the road that you take from Tuscaloosa to, to the road now that you take from Tuscaloosa to Atlanta goes past the Hamilton Homes Parkway. And Hamilton Homes was my orthopedic upper level. And I did not know about him. I just thought he was this incredible teacher. Only after I did my 2 weeks under his tutelage did people say, "You had Hamilton Holmes. Oh my gosh." And they explained who his significance as having been the pioneer at the University of Georgia and withstanding all the abuse that he had to integrate that university. But, you know, there's a lot of cross currents here, but I think that, as a witness to this report, as I was, I wonder if you could comment, because by the time you graduated, you went on to being a resident at Cornell in New York, and then you were a fellow in hematology, and did that. But what was there any scuttlebutt about this report? Did you sense that physicians were taking the this issue seriously and going to do more? Because my father did, but my father had a heart attack in his 40s, and that's what got him angry about smoking. He smoked two packs a day of Chesterfield that he started in medical school. But I wondered whether, in your experience in Boston and New York, was this an issue that people cared about?
Well, it did become quite an issue that doctors did talk about it quite a bit. Because the image that the tobacco industry had promoted prior to that time was that this was a very sophisticated hobby, that it showed one's level of acceptance socially. And they really painted a picture that people who were indeed at the top of the social ladder really frequently were smokers. So this really did cause quite a bit of commentary. And I remember, for example, when I started at Cornell, I applied for an internship there. There had never been a graduate of Boston University in the program, training program there, and they had never had an African-American intern there. So when I went there for an interview, after the first interview, I was asked to say to meet the chairman of the department, and I was quite pleasantly surprised because I hadn't anticipated that I would be accepted. And when I went in, and I didn't even know who the chairman of medicine was, but when they showed me into his office about an hour after my first interview, turns out there was a haze of smoke that came into the waiting room when they opened the door into the chairman's office. He was a cardiologist. His name was Ehu Lucky. And of course, this was a new experience. And of course, I was very surprised at the haze of smoke that came out. And I know this was something that I and the other interns talked about because we were really quite impressed by that. So when the report came a few years later, this reinforced it. So it really was the report that got a lot of attention. It was talked about quite a bit. It promoted a lot of research that built upon the Surgeon General's report of 64, showing, of course, cancer in other organs, pulmonary fibrosis, etc. So it really was, for me at that time, a very, it was a change agent and discussed a lot of work and stimulated a lot of work, yes.
When you were in New York, by any chance, across the street at Sloan Kettering, did you ever run into one of the only individuals in that era who was actively speaking out on smoking, which was Bill Cahan, the chest surgeon at Sloan Kettering?
I don't recall meeting him, so I don't.
Yeah, I knew Bill very well in the 1980s and 1990s, and he just was terrific. Even at Sloan Kettering, they were not. Ernst Winder was doing work on trying to develop a safer cigarette. But really, there were very few we would even call activists in that era. Mm-hmm. But I know, too, that the American Medical Association was a big disappointment. They accepted, up to initially $5 million and then a total of $18 million between 64 and 80 and 78 to continue to study the issue. They were the only health organization that did not endorse the report. It's mind-boggling.
Right. Well, I can share with you that in 1975, I came back to Atlanta to develop the Morehouse School of Medicine. And one of the people we recruited for our board of trustees for the medical school was in the advertising business. And he promised that he would get us support for the school from the tobacco industry. And I remember telling him, oh, no, don't do that. We are not interested. We don't want that. And so I know that in 1975, 11 years after the Surgeon General's report, the reaction towards tobacco use was sufficient at that time that I felt that it would be very inappropriate for a medical school training doctors to be getting support from tobacco industry. So we never got that because my trustee really didn't, at the time, didn't see the harm from that. But I said, no, that we would not have any scientific integrity if we were to accept tobacco funding. And we wanted to be sure that our graduates not only had a good knowledge base, but also had a strong sense of ethics and character and interest in their patients so that they would be working to encourage their patients to adopt healthy lifestyles. So that was another measure of the impact of the Surgeon General's report some 11 years later as we were starting the new medical school.
You may have been more alone than you think, because I can think of very few medical schools or even hospitals that were still not accepting or had no policy against accepting such money. For instance, MD Anderson Cancer Institute in Houston did not even divest its tobacco stocks until the late 1990s. They did not even go smoke-free until the 1990s. It's astounding. And I think all of the major medical schools in New York City were still, they still had researchers who were taking funds from what was called the Council for Tobacco Research. And this is one of my gripes, is that the Surgeon General's report had 7,000 papers to look through. That's what the advisory committee did. And by 1985, Dr. Koop said, well, now we have 50,000 papers. I don't think we need to do more proof, because the industry was kept saying we need more research. And today, when I wrote in The Lancet 2 years ago, an article called Tobacco Control, All Research, No Action, there I counted by a search online, a Google Scholar, that there are now over 356,000 papers on tobacco. I mean, I think at some point, the research gambit should have played itself out when it came to taking action on tobacco. And Dr. Cahan had a very fierce debate, which we have on our website for the center, between him and and John Brademas, who had been the congressman who became the head of New York University, over the naming of the biggest hospital at NYU, Tisch Hospital, named after the Tisch family, who owned Lorillard Tobacco Company. So we have Bowman Gray, which was named after an executive of R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. We have Duke, founded by the Duke tobacco fortune. And believe it or not, as late as 2018 or 19, Meharry took funding from Juul, the electronic cigarette manufacturer, to do more research. Right. So I think you were not only ahead of the crowd, I think you may have been literally alone, in especially as a new medical school, in turning down that largesse.
Well, one of the other things that happened in retrospect, thinking about this, in our early years, I was visited by a psychiatrist friend from New York who brought, while he visited me, he gave me a supply of lapel pins with the logo saying tobacco smoking is inhibited. So I wore that all the time. And as it turns out, that when I was nominated to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, I visited members of the Senate committee that would be involved in confirming my appointment as secretary. One of those people was Senator Jesse Helms there in North Carolina. So when I visited him, I had, first of all of the visits that I made, which were monitored and helped by Alan Simpson, Senator from Wyoming. He was majority whip at the time. Well, when I visited Senator Helms, he noted my lapel pin. And of course, he made it very clear that he objected to that. And even in 1989, he was making statements such as, there's really no real proof that tobacco really causes cancer. And what is it about you that makes you think that you really have the qualifications to be secretary? With the discussion we had, I indicated to him that if I were confirmed as secretary, among the things I would be doing would be urging people to improve their lifestyles. And one of the main things that I would be urging they do to improve their lifestyles was to stop smoking. because of a large number of deaths and the injuries and illness caused by tobacco. And of course, with tobacco being a major crop from North Carolina, he disagreed with that. And when I left his office, I knew that I did not have his vote. Sure enough, my confirmation vote was 98-1. And of course, that one vote was Jesse Helms.
You should be very proud.
Oh, yes. I said to my friends in Atlanta, had I gotten the vote from Jesse Helms, I would have had a lot of explaining to do as to why he was supporting me. So at any rate, that was the one experience. So it was really shows that it wasn't that long ago that the tobacco industry marshaled a lot of support, and they still have that lingering support. And unfortunately, too many organizations accept funds from the tobacco industry. And you mentioned the support that Meharry's received. When that happened, I had quiet conversations with my colleagues at Meharry, urging that they send the money back, because I explained to them that the tobacco industry would use that connection to try and give some legitimacy to their arguments that tobacco was not as harmful as it really really is. So it has been a major challenge over the years. And it shows how difficult it can be to change people's behavior. We see it in other areas, such as the vaccine hesitancy that we have now among our population.
The title of the exhibition that I'm completing with my colleague Bryce Callahan, the Lost Legacy of the Surgeon General's Report, has a quote at the top, the most addictive thing about tobacco is the money. And this was quoted by my colleague, Dr. Ed Anselm, an internist and a managed care executive in New York City, who has worked with me we've worked together for 40 years. And he was struck not just by the dependence of the tobacco industry on money, but by the dependence of the health community on I have a grant, therefore I exist. They really would rather study the issue than act on it. But you did more than that, and I appreciate your sharing the observation about both Jesse Helms and about Meharry. There was a congressman at the time, you may remember, Thomas Bliley from Virginia, and they used to call him the congressman from Philip Morris. Mm-hmm. And it was extraordinary. People don't realize the extent of the power of the industry. When I was fired as editor of the New York State Journal of Medicine after 3 years and producing two theme issues on the tobacco issue, the first that had been published. And I knew that the lobby of the tobacco industry in Albany was pretty close with the lobby for the medical society. I don't think that was proven that they actually had anything to do with my firing. But I do feel that it was a sad day when I walked in and was told to get out after the medical society had commended me on my bringing this to the public's attention. But I was told when I got a new job at Baylor College of Medicine that maybe I ought to get into something more socially acceptable in my research, like cocaine. I mean, that was actually a quote from a dean, because they were so afraid that my activism would offend the tobacco industry on the Hill. But the other interesting moment was when I led my group of activists to protest the Marlboro Country Music Festival in Houston. We pulled up in our vehicles to the outside of this event, and we saw other picketers going around. And we said, hey, wait a minute, we were supposed to picket. What are you doing? It was the ACT UP people protesting against Jesse Helms. So we talked, and we agreed that we were going to join each other's picket line to protest the Marlboro Country Music Festival in Houston.
Right.
It's interesting that you picked up on something that made national attention, that brought that you were outspoken. I don't know whether you did this with the approval of the administration, but you were especially upset about not just the introduction of a brand called Uptown, clearly aimed at minority populations. It was test marketed in Philadelphia, and Reverend Jesse Brown had led this cry against, why do you keep targeting us? And you're putting up billboards in our neighborhoods. You don't go out to the suburbs and do that. And just a wonderful person. You joined that call against R.J. Reynolds, and you also took it upon yourself to call for an end to tobacco sponsorship of sports. How about a little background to that?
Yes, well, that happened in 1990. I had a trip to the Middle East, 2 weeks there in the Middle East, a week in Egypt, and a week in Israel. The official reason for that trip was to review research that the U.S. was supporting in those two countries on such things as mosquito control, et cetera, in terms of malaria. But underneath this work that we were reviewing was really the effort to get these countries to work together. So this was a mechanism that we were using. So on the way back from the Middle East, and my wife was with me, we stopped in Rome and visited the Vatican. And then as we came from Rome back to the U.S., turns out the International Herald Tribune on the plane had this article about the community in Philadelphia objecting to R.J. Reynolds' plans to introduce this new cigarette in the community called Uptown. That was the first I had heard about it. So I read the article, and it so happened that 1 week later, I was scheduled to be in Philadelphia speaking at the University of Pennsylvania at the dedication of a new research building that had been built in part with grant funds from NIH. So I told my wife, you know, when I go up there, I'm going to really pull out all the stops. And I was outraged. The next morning at my 8 o'clock meeting with my senior staff, I came in and put this newspaper on the table in front of me and ask, does anyone know anything about this? Everyone in the room started smiling. I then said, what's so funny? Well, what was funny was they had been busy talking to each other while I was away, figuring out how could they convince me to really speak out against that, that plan. So the procedures that we followed in making public talks would be to send over to the White House several days before the event a copy of the speech so that we'd see that the Secretary of Education was speaking about things that really didn't conflict with what Secretary of Health or Secretary of Labor would be saying. So I understood that because we wanted to be sure that the administration was very clear in what our positions were, et cetera. But I told my staff, now on next Wednesday, this was Wednesday, I was to speak in Philadelphia, send my speech over at 8 o'clock Wednesday morning. And I was speaking at 10 o'clock. So, I knew very well that by the time the White House knew that the speech was there, I would be on my way back to Washington from Philadelphia. But I also knew that what was going to happen was unpredictable because I was going to be violating our protocol. But I had decided that it would be much easier for me to ask for forgiveness than to ask for permission. I didn't want to be put in the position of being told, asked by the chief of staff or the president not to give that speech. And so I knew that by the end of the day on Wednesday, I might possibly be on a plane back to Atlanta. So I didn't know, but I felt so strongly. I said that if I have any credibility as secretary, I have to really do everything I can to protect and promote the health of Americans. And this is a blatant effort that really goes in the opposite direction. Well, to make a long story short, nothing happened. I never got a call from the White House. I did learn later that the lobbyists for the tobacco industry called the White House. They were enraged by the speech I made. John Sununu, our chief of staff, told the lobbyists, well, I'll speak with the president as you want me to do, but I can't guarantee you what the outcome will be. So he spoke to the president, and the only thing I ever heard was about 10 days later at a cabinet meeting, before the meeting began, President Bush said, Lou, we're noticing you speaking about tobacco, and we're behind you. We may be a little bit too far behind you, but we're behind you. Wow. That was it. So that was it, because I felt that to be honest with the American public, my position would be to promote those activities that were to lead to healthy behavior and protecting the health of Americans, same with that. Nations, et cetera. So the consequence of my speaking out, that speech was 18 minutes that day. There were 3 minutes devoted to my condemning R.J. Reynolds for their plans to introduce Uptown. The 15 minutes was about the benefits to our society of having this research facility, adding to the capability of that research center, developing new knowledge. So that was it. So I never received a reprimand or anything like that. It was casual comment, which in essence, the president was telling me, you did okay. But he wasn't, that was as close as he was going to get, because we knew the tobacco industry worked to have people sympathetic to their industry, working as White House staff to really try and avoid things such as the speech that I gave in Philadelphia.
You know, that's a terrific context that you've put this in. It just reminded me that Karl Rove, the Republican strategist of that era, was an executive of Philip Morris. When he was not in Washington, he'd go back to Philip Morris, and then he'd come back to D.C. to get some government role. But that gave you a sense of the revolving door between the tobacco industry and the federal government. And this is under both the parties, by the way. It's not unique to Republicans. It's funny, you also reminded me, contemporaneous with your, I think, remarkable effort, because it really brought attention not only to Jesse Brown's work, but to saying we're not going to take this anymore. I think it really startled not just the tobacco industry, but also individuals like Benjamin Hooks, because one of the recordings, I think it's maybe the best item on our whole website, is, sad to say, a recording that was sent to me that someone had made at an NAACP meeting, where Benjamin Hooks was the longtime executive director, and he introduced the Spingarden Award dinner with this glowing praise of George Knox, who was the head of a vice president for minority, I call it minority marketing, but it was minority affairs for Philip Morris. And he actually challenged the world and said, people ask me, why do we take money from Philip Morris? We're proud to take that money. And why don't they go to Time Magazine or all those other organizations and ask, why don't they stop taking them? Why do they always pick on us, the minorities? Which I thought was a very good point. But nonetheless, I think it shook up a lot of people at the Urban League, at the NAACP, and La Raza, and other minority organizations, and United Negro College Fund, that had been openly taking tobacco industry money. And then you also, I sent to your wonderful communications director, Gail Converse, the headline from the Atlanta Journal of you holding up, well, actually, it was one of our t-shirts, throw tobacco out of sports, and calling for the industry to get out of sports and calling for sports bodies to reject their funding. And we're going to put that with this interview. But what sparked that? Because that, I think, really opened the floodgates, I think, along with Congressman Waxman. You were the most outspoken on tobacco sponsorship of sports.
Well, I wanted to do everything I could to bring attention of the American public to the adverse effects of tobacco on health, knowing that the percentage of deaths and illness in the African-American community on a per capita basis was higher in the African-American community. And so I wanted to do everything I could using the office of the secretary to get that message to the public. And there were leaders in the Black community with whom I worked. One of them was the late Reverend Calvin Butts, who was minister of the Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York. And during the time I was secretary, he would lead groups in Harlem that would plaster over or whitewash these advertising signs on walls in the Black community and urge the confectionaries to take the ads that were in the windows of their shops out, because he was trying to improve the health of the community as well. And one of the things, and this happened before the Uptown incident, when he was doing this, an article appeared in the New York Times, and I called him, and I knew him because Calvin Butts was also a graduate of Morehouse College. So I had met him at college events. So I called him and said, "Calvin, you didn't get this call, but I just want you to know you're doing a great job." So there was a lot of support from him and other people like him. So this has divided the minority community, because there are those in the community who are concerned and who are trying to decrease tobacco use. But unfortunately, it's still too many organizations and people who are accepting money. And to me, that's really undermining the efforts. And by the way, the net result of that Uptown speech that I gave was that 2 weeks later, I received a letter from the president of R.J. Reynolds informing me that they were not proceeding with the introduction of this new cigarette. So that was the end of Uptowns. So I felt very good about that.
I think it was an important thing. I've talked to Jesse Brown, and I've said it was really a miraculous effort. It was well supported by a lot of people. Of course, Reynolds then came back and introduced another brand, which they called Salem Box, with almost the same kind, different colors. By the way, we created a brand to spoof Uptown. We called it Upchuck. And we had I'll have to send you the pack that we designed with our artist, Doug Minkler. I think ridicule is another approach, and that's what we've done through the years of making fun. We called it the Emphysema Slims Tennis Tournament instead of Virginia Slims. And but then I think that the issue is that the response of the tobacco companies, particularly the head of Philip Morris at the time, George Weissman, was that people like me and you were kooks. They actually called us kooks and fanatics, and They said, Weissman actually said, we don't target minorities. We target everyone. He literally said, we target everyone. And I think in a way, whether that's a Freudian slip, but he said, no, we don't discriminate. We go after all we can who are adults. We want them to smoke our products. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting issue. But going on to sports, did you meet with any, opposition? You know, there was a program called Yes Minister on British TV, and there was one episode called the smoke screen. And it showed how the prime minister, who didn't care about smoking, was able to get his tax cut by supporting the health minister, who wanted to ban cigarette advertising. And also he got the support of the sports minister, who wanted to get more tobacco funding of sports. And it's a funny kind of an episode, but it shows you that the health minister was not as powerful as the sports minister, because they just love that British American tobacco money. But clearly, you must have gotten pushback from NASCAR and the women's tennis tour and other sports where the title sponsor, Winston Cup Racing or Marlboro Cup, was the actual tobacco company.
Yes, this would be in the form of comments ridiculing these efforts. And first of all, trying to question the science, question the basis for this, but also questioning the fact that they were trying to make the point that we were stepping on the rights of Americans to make their own choice, because they would always say that we're not asking teenagers to smoke. We think smoking is an adult choice. And so that's the market that we shoot for, when so much data shows the kinds of things they put in their ads would be attractive to teenagers, et cetera. And it so happens that a high school classmate of mine ended up working for Philip Morris. And he ended up working in the White House. And the sad story with him.
You're not talking about Stanley S. Scott, are you?
Stanley Scott, yes.
Yes, right. I that's an amazing individual.
Right. You know, he was, you know, prominent family here in Atlanta.
The Coretta Scott King was
his family. Really, and also he volunteered to get funding for us as well. And I told him, Stan, no, we really are not interested, but we don't want that. That we want funds, but we want funds that are really not impaired by being profits from the deaths or the illness of people. So unfortunately, as you know, Stan developed lung cancer and died from it.
I have to tell you a little story, because in 1986, after I'd been fired by the New York State Journal of Medicine and was pretty much floundering, looking for another position, I got a call from the Washington Post asking if I would write about the targeting of minorities by the tobacco industry for their Sunday viewpoint section. And I worked on this, handed what I thought was a really good commentary. And the editor called me back. He says, no, you didn't get the response from Philip Morris. I said, what do you mean? You mean I have to call up the tobacco companies and ask for their response? He says, yeah, you got to do that. Hmm. So I had to call Stanley S. Scott, who I recognized was the vice president for minority affairs at Philip Morris. And I remember the hearing the silence at the other end of the line when he got on the phone and he said, is this Dr. Alan Blum, the anti-smoking activist? I said, well, Mr. Scott, you could call me that, but I think for the purposes of this interview, I have to be a journalist asking for your comments on this. Well, within about 15 minutes, he was inviting me to dinner. We talked about our common relationships because, as I mentioned, my uncles were very involved with Coretta Scott King's family, and they were patients. Her kids were patients of my uncle and so forth. And, of course, I knew the Atlanta Daily World, which I read when I was in Atlanta at medical school, the one of the foremost newspapers. And we just talked, and I asked him about his service for President Nixon and the fact that under Nixon, people don't realize this, more minority physicians gained access to medical school positions than under any other administration. Mm-hmm. Through the legislation that Stanley S. Scott helped to guide under Nixon. I mean, so you give people credit. But the sad ending of this story is, although I didn't take him up on his offer to have dinner, I was invited to speak, I guess, about 20 years ago at the LSU Comprehensive Cancer Center. Mm-hmm. And as I walked in a couple of hours earlier, I saw over the top Stanley S. Scott Comprehensive Cancer Center. And I went in and I asked the person who was the head of the center, I said, by the way, do you know who Stanley S. Scott was? And he says, sure, he ran the Miller Beer distributorship here. I said, well, he had been a vice president for a cigarette company. Miller Beer was owned by that cigarette company. And he said, please don't mention that. Don't mention that during the talk. But I thought it was, I thought I had a lot of respect for Stanley Scott. And I did not know that he was someone that was a classmate.
Yes, right. And his family was very prominent here in Atlanta.
Yes.
Because
he was a journalist.
I'm sorry?
He was a journalist, basically, too.
Oh, yes. Yes. But there was an organization called the Hungry Club here in Atlanta. In those years, Blacks were not given membership in the Rotary Club. So the Butler Street YMCA had this group that was formed in the Black community called the Hungry Club. And so they would speak. And so Stanley's dad was the owner of the Atlanta Daily World and would speak. So Stanley and his father and his family, they were very staunch Republicans, but they were working with the Democrats, Black Democrats, really for the same purpose. So they're really repealing the white primary here in Georgia, where if you were African-American, you couldn't vote in the primaries. You could vote in the main election, but you couldn't vote in the election to select the candidates for each party. So they fought that. So I knew Stanley and his family very well. And of course, when he became a White House staffer, we you know were very excited for him. But we had that disagreement. We remained friends, but that was one time that he offered to be helpful, but we really couldn't accept that. Yeah.
I would be remiss in not acknowledging some of the individuals that you've alluded to. You've been married, if I'm not mistaken, to Ginger Williamson for 68 years?
That's correct, right.
Could you share a little bit more about her?
Well, yes. Well, that was a very interesting event, the way that happened.
You met at Morehouse, was that correct?
I met her in my first year in medical school. When I went to Boston, that was my first time living in a non-segregated environment. It's 1954, which also was the year of Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision. So at Boston University, two blocks away was a female dormitory called the Franklin Square House. Ginger had come down to Boston from Pittsfield, Massachusetts, in the western part of the state, to attend Northeastern University. And so I was introduced by a fraternity brother I had met there in Boston, who was trying to help me acclimatize to my new surroundings. And so I met Ginger. She was a great tennis player, and we really hit it off. I didn't have much money, so that we would walk along the Charles River for dates. And I had sung in the Morehouse College Glee Club, because Morehouse has always had an outstanding choir. So I would sing along Glee Club songs. And so that worked. So we got married my next year, my sophomore year in medical school. And so we've been together all these years and have three children, all of them born in Boston. They're, of course, now grown-ups. Have really had a great life together. And I also should mention that the things I've been able to accomplish, she deserves a lot of credit for it, because she is the glue for our family. And while I was busy down at Boston City Hospital or at BU Medical School, she would be taking care of the family and doing all of those things. So, and she also worked during my internship. And so she helped bring in funds for the family as well. So she's been a true partner all these years.
Thank you for sharing. I had two questions about your Boston years. Now, you talk about a non-segregated environment, but Boston was known notoriously for the violence shown toward African-Americans during the era of busing and other issues. I don't think it gets off the hook for as being a quote, non-segregated environment.
Well, no, it's interesting. You're speaking of the era of Louise Day Hicks,
yes,
who's a Boston City Council person. She came to power in the late 50s when they were promoting busing to integrate the schools. And of course, she lived in South Boston. And she actually was quite successful in generating a lot of opposition. So that it was interesting that I entered medical school in September of 54, was well received there at BU and in Boston, finding a place to rent. But by the late 50s, the tensions in Boston had developed quite dramatically, so that someone entering Boston, going to Boston in the late 50s, had a very different experience than someone in the mid 50s. When I went, for example, with all of the history of Boston, with the American Revolution and the Tea Parties and the shootings at the Concord Bridge and then Lexington Minutemen and Paul Revere, I really was very interested in that history, things I had read about or been taught about. So I really took the tour of Boston, also the various cultural organizations, the museums, the symphony, all of the universities, the beautiful river between Boston and Cambridge. So for me, it was a very pleasant experience, but then became very different later on. And I ended up on the faculty at Boston University. And I know that in 1968, when King was assassinated, I was assistant professor at the medical school, and several of us worked to recruit more Black students, not only to Boston University, but to Harvard and Tufts, Dartmouth, Vermont, UMass, because when King was assassinated, we all looked at our universities or our medical schools and saw that we had very few Blacks. And the reaction we had, and of course, this was similar to the rest of the universities and around the country, that the King's work we took up. And so we worked very hard, but we ran into this problem because of the tensions that had been generated by the busing controversy there in Boston. So it was really very unfortunate. And today we're going through a similar phase with the resistance now. So it's unfortunate. But because I say that we have made, in the same way that we have made progress in reducing tobacco use, but we still have more to achieve to improve the health of Americans. The same with our divisions within our society. Not only in those years, the minority community was the African-American community. Today, the minority community includes not only African-Americans, but Latinos, Native Americans, and other immigrants. And I find it unfortunate and ironic, and frankly, to me, a conflict in our value system to see the very strong anti-immigrant feelings in our community. I certainly agree that we need to do better in terms of the integrity of our borders. But some of the measures that are being used, I really find, as an American, really objectionable, because all of these individuals are human. And the only group here in America, in our diverse society, that you could say are the true Native Americans are the American Indians. All of us came from somewhere else. We've all learned to live together. So I'm hoping that we can get through this period and maintain our value system, because what we profess to believe in is very encouraging, very inspiring, but sometimes in the execution or living up to it, we fall short. And so as an American, I really want to do everything I can, not only to improve the health of Americans, but the level of education and the quality of life that we enjoy. So hopefully we will reach that goal at some time in the future.
You know, listening to you, it reminds me of Charles Blow of the New York Times and his columns describing his upbringing in Louisiana, the same in the very same neighborhood as the current Speaker of the House, and his contrasting viewpoints and describing the relative difficulties that someone of a minority population faces compared to those who have traditionally been entitled. As we begin to wrap it up, I just want to mention again how much I appreciate your tribute to your own family doctor growing up, Dr. Joseph Griffin, and to your dad and to your mom in rural Georgia, and what they did for you, and to the high school teachers, because I really fear that we're not appreciating the most important people, the most important occupation, high school and grade school teachers. And you brought that out so beautifully.
Well, I really was very fortunate that I had great role models growing up, starting with my parents, because my father, when we moved from Atlanta to Blakely, really brought suit against the school system because it was separate but not equal. For example, the white high school had a band with instruments. There was no band at the black school. The white school had a library. The black school didn't, et cetera. So he worked against that. And so as a result of that, he had difficulty living there. And actually, someone shot my father. They tried to kill him. He survived that. But that was the experience. But they sent my brother and me back to Atlanta when I was starting in fifth grade, my brother in sixth grade, so that we would get a better education. And so in Atlanta, we were exposed not only to the faculty of the black colleges here in Atlanta, but also to the black businessmen, doctors, others. But in Southwest Georgia, there was one black physician you alluded to, Dr. Joseph Griffin. He was someone I totally admired because he had skills that no one else had. He could treat people who were sick and cure them, make them well. He also treated his patients with respect. Whereas when we had two doctors in Blakely, white, and when you went to see them, you'd have to go around back through a separate entrance to wait until he had taken care of all of the white patients. His patients who were black would always be addressed by their first name, be John or Mary, rather than Mr. Johnson or Mrs. Smith, et cetera. And we noticed that, and we resented that, because of all of these very blatant signals trying to say that you are less worthy, et cetera. So Dr. Griffin, because of his skills and also because he treated his patients with respect, I admired, and he was very successful. So by the time I was age five, I was very clear I wanted to be a doctor. So he was my first professional role model. And as you mentioned, my teachers in school, I admired also. And my mother was a teacher as well. And so I loved learning. And I was always curious about the factors, how do trees grow? Or birds sing? Or why do waves occur at the beach, et cetera? Things like that we would talk about. So I always loved learning. And so I really had people who encouraged me all along. And of course, my experience at Morehouse College was, again, reinforcing the president of the college, Dr. Benjamin Mays, really, who inspired all of us. And of course, he was a role model for Martin Luther King Jr.
Did you know Dr. King in Boston? Did you ever run into him when he was in Boston?
No, it was very interesting. I never did. I went to Boston in 1954. He was there at the School of Religion, and I believe he left in 1956 to go to Alabama. So I did not know him, but I heard about him. But I met him later in 1963 when he visited, and my wife and I attended Christ Church there in the Cambridge Common. And so he visited there, and that's when he made his speech about bringing peace to Vietnam.
Which he was reviled for.
Oh, I know. It was. So he was a truly remarkable person. And then later, of course, when he was assassinated in April of 68, we had the reaction at the medical school that I mentioned, and we brought in many more Black students, not only at Boston University, but at Harvard, Tufts, Dartmouth, UMass as well, because we took the work that King was trying to accomplish as our own work as a result of his leadership.
Just as we wrap it up, in 1997, Dr. Koop called me when he had been asked, he said, keep this under your hat. He said, I've been asked, this is as the state attorney generals were suing the tobacco industry for all the damage that they'd done to health, and they were aiming to get billions and billions. And he said, I think they're going to reach a settlement. And they've asked me to be the master of the funding that is going to come from this industry. Part of it will be going to fight smoking. And they're going to be giving us a few billion dollars. And he said, they're going to have me running the books and overseeing this. And I said, wow. He says, I'm calling you because I said I will do this under only one condition, that the first $100 million goes toward rebuilding the National Health Museum on the Mall in Washington, and of which $10 million will go to you, Dr. Blum, to direct the tobacco component of the museum. He says, don't tell anyone, but keep your fingers crossed. Mm-hmm. Well, I had reservations about that whole deal anyway, because I would rather have seen some of these tobacco executives go to prison rather than just getting money. But, you know, I said, wow, that there'll be something if we could build this museum. And then, of course, that fell through when Senator McCain jacked up the price and they voted against this agreement. The next year, a much weaker agreement was agreed to. And they did get some money, but that went to somebody else, and that started the American Legacy Foundation, which I personally think they squandered a lot of that money and didn't really do what, you know, only 2% of that money goes to fight smoking today, by the way, that was given to the states under the Master Settlement Agreement. But you have a passion all these years with Dr. Koop for the revival of the National Health Museum. I should add that there is the National Museum of Health and Medicine, which is the military medicine museum that's out now. They've got a beautiful new building in Bethesda. Mm-hmm. But that Adrian Noe, the remarkable director, has been there for over 30 years. But it's been a real difficult time to try to see us not getting this museum, which I have been hoping. Is there any chance that even a virtual National Health Museum might get us off the ground? Or,
well, I would love to see that, but we really had a difficult time. And of course, While I really am pleased with the things that we have accomplished, the National Health Museum is one of those things that we were not successful in developing. And I found that it was difficult to explain the concept to people in such a way that they understood why this was important and what we were trying to do. Because here we were trying to give people information as to what is a healthy lifestyle, what is the value of exercise, how does diet influence one, what about sunlight, what about allergens, medical checkups, et cetera. And of course, Chick Koop had started the whole concept of the National Health Museum. So trying to explain this and then trying to find land, because as you probably know, we had hoped to put this on the Mall there in Washington, but could never find land for it. And then I became involved, and we then decided to look around the country and see if there would be another site for it. So we were not successful with that. And so this was one of those things that we finally reluctantly said that this is something that whose time is not yet here, but hopefully will come. So I would love to see it, but this is something I think for the next generation to develop.
Well, on a more hopeful note, I will just continue to keep the pilot light lit for this, because I think these days of virtual media, just as we're speaking now through Zoom, I think that there is, especially in this era of disinformation, of hate, of AI remaking history, of vaccine lunacy, it's a National Health Museum with a name attached such as yours and others in the health field would mean a lot. It would really counteract this age of disinformation. And so I'll hold out hope for this and hope we can merge our tobacco website into it. But it's a sad thing that we're seeing so much disinformation. We're seeing infectious diseases that we thought we had eradicated reemerging. We're seeing vaccine rates in Mississippi, which had the best vaccination program. More exemptions now are being given for vaccines now in Mississippi, I think, than any other state. It's gone from having the best vaccination program heading toward one of the worst. So we have our work cut out for us. But I hope that you'll have this hope that maybe we could revive this idea. And I would love to see this as capping your remarkable career.
Right. Thank you very much. I would love to see that, because I think it would do so much. Because I often say that a healthy nation is a wealthy nation. That is, if you have a healthy population, they can be more productive in innovation, developing goods and services, and wealth in the community, and independence. So that it really goes beyond health, but it goes to the fiber of the nation itself. So this would have many benefits. That I would be happy to join with anyone to really try and make that happen.
It's sort of sad that the CDC museum, I've had some concerns. They had invited me to have an exhibition when they opened, but it was literally blocked. I still don't know the exact, it was called Cartoonists Take Up Smoking. It wound up going to the National Museum of Health and Medicine for a full year, and Adrian kept extending it. But the CDC saw it, and somebody wrote and said, why don't we have it here in Atlanta? And part of it was because a lot of the cartoons made fun of people like Jesse Helms and Bob Dole, who did not believe that the tobacco issue was an important one. But in any event, I think that an independent National Health Museum that would really be something. I watched these commercials today for Keytruda, and I wonder, why are these being advertised? At $150,000 a year drug being advertised to the general public, I don't understand this. They could be taking that kind of money to really help educate people how to prevent cancer. But it's really we're still not there yet, Dr. Sullivan. Mm-hmm. And right. Please, I hope you'll continue to lend your voice to getting better education for people on prevention and not just treatment after the fact.
Well, I certainly intend to do everything I can to improve the health of Americans because I see this as a dual calling. I feel very good when we're able to help educate the public or I could write something that would be of value. So indeed, I'd be very happy to be involved.
You haven't missed a beat and you haven't skipped a step. I just can't thank you enough for taking the time and for Gail Converse to help arrange this. And best wishes for everything you do for Morehouse and for health in America. Thank you so much, Dr. Sullivan.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for listening to the Cancer History Project podcast, a podcast of oral histories and interviews with the people who have shaped oncology as we know it. Our archives are available online for free at cancerhistoryproject.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @cancerhistproj. The Cancer History Project is a collaborative historical resource operated by the Cancer Letter. This is an ongoing project and would not be possible without the input and materials provided by our editorial board, our contributors, and the support of our sponsors, including Cedars-Sinai, Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and many others. View a full list of our sponsors at cancerhistoryproject.com/sponsors. If your institution would like to participate in the Cancer History Project, email us at admin@cancerhistoryproject.com.